ventilation is first and foremost a support function. It's designed to support the two primary critical tasks of fire attack and search. Ventilation shouldn't precede getting a primary search done or shouldn't come at the detriment of getting that first line into position.
This is Code 3, the Firefighters Podcast, hosted by award-winning journalist Scott Orr. Now, here's Scott.
That's right, and I will not let Parkinson stop me. Thank you for joining me again for another edition of Code 3. You are listening to the show for and about firefighters. Give me about 20 minutes and I'll give you a firefighting topic to think about. Let's get started. Do you know exactly how vertical ventilation works? Depending on your level of experience, you may think you do, but you might not have a really solid understanding of why it works. Just cutting a random 4x4-foot hole in the roof won't do the job in all cases, and there's a reason for that. My guest today has a good deal of experience as a firefighter, but he admits that until he saw a live fire test, he misunderstood how cutting a hole in the roof affects the fire. We'll talk about that, as well as when's the best time to vent the roof, how dangerous it is to work up there, how hand lines can be used to move air and smoke with it, and how much training firefighters need to remain proficient in roof operations. Nick Papa is a 17-year veteran of the New Britain, Connecticut Fire Department, where he's a captain. He became a firefighter in 2003, volunteering for a neighboring suburb, until he was hired by New Britain. He is the author of the book Coordinating Ventilation, Supporting Extinguishment and Survivability. And Nick Papa joins me now. Thanks for being on Code 3.
Thanks for having me. I appreciate the invite.
It's great to have you on board. So let's start with the simple basic question. Is vertical ventilation itself a problem? Do we need to reassess the value of cutting holes in the roof?
There's not a problem with the tactic itself. I think there's certainly a misunderstanding and a misapplication in the use of it, more specifically the overuse of it. I think there's definitely some misconception in the sense of the effect that it has and also the threshold for timing. I think there was a long misinterpretation as to ventilation having this global lifting effect of the entire floor or, you know, space underneath the roof when the roof was vented. Myself included, you know, when I was a part of the UL-FSRI technical panel for the coordinated fire attack study. And my understanding, like a lot of other people, was that when we cut a hole in the roof, you know, regardless of compartmentation and, you know, other openings, that we were just going to have this, like I said, this global lifting effect where it was just going to lift that thermal layer, lift that smoke layer up and, you know, replace it with fresh air throughout that space, you know, because the hole was being cut up above.
And I gather that's not what's happening in every case.
That's correct. So it's going to be largely dependent on the supporting openings underneath, which are going to be the ones that will be functioning as the inlets, which are going to support the exchange. So one thing that's important to note about ventilation, like any other tactic, is how it works. So understanding the relationship between inlets and outlets, how they're oriented within the space, and how they're oriented in relation to the fire is going to determine what type of flow is generated, whether that's a bidirectional flow where we've got two-way flow where intake and exhaust are being shared by the same opening, which typically happens through doorways or windows on the same level as the fire. And then we have unidirectional flow, which is what we typically attribute to a vertical ventilation opening in that it produces a unidirectional or, you know, single direction flow, which is a dedicated exhaust. The reason why vertical ventilation is kind of viewed historically as kind of the king or the apex of ventilation is that it generates that dedicated exhaust. So from an efficiency standpoint, when it comes to that exchange, it's going to produce the most exhaust. But the thing to remember is that exchange is only happening between the inlets and between the and the outlet. So it doesn't matter that the opening is situated fully above in the roof or laterally through windows. the air exchange, that fresh air is only coming in to replace that smoke between that opening where the fire is. That's essentially what we has been termed the flow path. The flow path is the volume of the space between the inlets and outlets. So that's another common misconception with the terminology of ventilation, is that flow path, people use the word flow path to describe ventilation, and that's not the case. Ventilation is the exchange. The flow path is the volume of space where that ventilation is taking place. So I think that's a common misuse of the term that we kind of needed to address in this as well. In one of the experiments that we did that I actually was present for, it was in a 2.5-story wood frame, you know, legacy era construction. We set fires in the second floor. There was three bedrooms, a straight run staircase that ran up. You had a 180 around the newel post to the front bedroom, down the hallway. So one of the experiments where we were looking at the timing and effects of vertical ventilation, that we removed the two windows from that front room so that way it had a good supply of fresh air so we can allow that fire to achieve a steady state or a free burning, you know, state. And we then from there, we wanted to see how creating additional vertical ventilation and how it was timed in relation to fire attack was going to change conditions on the inside, which included the toxic gas concentrations, the temperatures, and also the intake of fresh air, the exchange of the gases as well. So in my eyes, when the 4x4 hole opening in the roof and the matching 4x4 hole in the ceiling beneath it, when those two were removed, that we were going to get this lifting effect of the entire second floor. However, that wasn't the case. In the second floor, there was two other adjacent bedrooms. There was also, you had a lengthy hallway that ran from front to back. Now, when we looked at the gas concentration sensors, the airflow sensors, we noted no appreciable change in conditions for, you know, no improvements for a significant amount of time, even after the onset of suppression in those remote spaces, even though the fact that we had two windows, which, you know, approximately was about 20 square feet of horizontal ventilation, and a 4x4 hole in the roof above that fire room, totaling above 16 square feet. So it's a significant amount of ventilation within the fire room. And we had no really notable improvements in conditions in the spaces adjacent. So the backside of the hallway, the two adjacent bedrooms, for a considerable amount of time, for a couple of minutes. And when we looked at everything in totality, what we realized was the lack of improvement was caused by the lack of air movement, the lack of exchange that was not occurring, or that was occurring in those spaces. So because the windows were still intact on the backside of the hallway and in those two adjacent bedrooms, there was no inlet within them to pull a local intake draft from. So those two spaces remain pressurized. So there's no exchange taking place throughout them. So that's the important thing to note too, is there's a difference between venting for extinguishment, so us venting for the nozzle team making the push, versus venting for search, you know, which is venting those locally, venting those remote spaces where search crews will be searching for trapped occupants to try and improve that that tenability within those individual spaces. So the only way that we get that local improvement is through local ventilation. And obviously that too needs to be coordinated in its own right, whether that's with the onset of effective suppression or that space is isolated prior to the ventilation taking place, so we don't create that pathway between the fire and that new point of low pressure through that local ventilation.
With all that in mind, what part of that contributes to the fact that we have so many videos of roof operations going wrong? We have firefighters going through the roof. Is this an example of bad timing or an unnecessary?
I think there's a lot of fear mongering that is associated with vertical ventilation. Bill Carey, who does extensive research on close calls and specifically line of duty deaths, he recently just published an article about the fear mongering and the misuse of the line of duty death data surrounding specifically, you know, roof ventilation or vertical ventilation. And there's a gross misrepresentation of roof ventilation being this like highly hazardous, you know, high risk evolution that's resulting in all of these fire ground fatalities and injuries. Now, listen, I'm not saying that it doesn't carry risk. It does, just like any other operation on the fire ground. And of course, you know, peaked roof ventilation is going to carry additional inherent risks versus flat roof ventilation, of course, because of, you know, the steep pitch and, you know, the challenges with traction and, you know, your ability to maintain balance in that position. Of course, those are going to add additional challenges, additional risks. However, if you were to look at strictly the line of duty death data as your metric for gauging the riskiness of an operation, there are far more there's far other operations that exceed that risk factor using solely that as a metric. So I think there's a lot of false narratives surrounding it. So that kind of addresses the people that are anti-vertical ventilation, but also that there needs to be some tempering on those that are pro-vertical ventilation. Now, vertical ventilation has and always will maintain a place within our tactical arsenal. It's always going to be something that we're going to maintain and something that's going to have merit and be effective when it's used appropriately. Now, like I kind of alluded to earlier, I think the problem on the other side of the coin is the overuse or it being the default approach. And now, in most cases, when we're talking about, you know, residential fires, specifically single family dwelling fires, are by and large the predominant fire across the nation. And now, when we look at these fires, the vast majority of them are occurring in the living spaces. The thing about living spaces is we have an ample supply of windows typically within each of the compartments within those dwellings. So, which makes horizontal ventilation a very effective and efficient tactic for us to utilize. And now when we couple that and coordinate it with a flowing and moving fire attack, you know, you have a solid nozzle team that is able to flow and move as they advance, we could actually achieve that same efficiency by hydraulically creating that unidirectional flow just on a horizontal plane, because we know that a flowing and moving hand line is going to entrain its own fresh air. For as just a rough idea, a 1¾-inch hand line flowing 150 gallons a minute, which is our baseline residential flow, you know, moved at a moderate speed in either the O or the upside down U or the Z pattern, whatever, is going to flow, is going to move roughly 5,000 cubic feet per minute of air. Now, to put that into context that people can, you know, readily, you know, associate with, if you went to Lowe's or Home Depot and bought the largest, you know, 52-inch diameter ceiling fan that you could buy at the store, put it on the highest setting after you installed it, that's roughly 5,000 cubic feet per minute of air. So 5,000 is a considerable amount of air, but not to the extent of, you know, even the portable battery powered units that are becoming commonplace. Those are somewhere in the range of, you know, 8,000 to 12,000 or 10,000 to 15,000, depending on size, but somewhere in that range. So we're not to the extent of these electric or battery powered fans, but we're, you know, moving a considerable enough air to where we can use that pressurization to our advantage. That water that we're mapping around that space is cooling the gases, it's cooling the surfaces, it's cooling the fuels, and we know that cooling results in contraction of gases. Any opening that we create, even just opening up a door to gain entry, is going to be a form of ventilation. We can't forget that. So when we open up that door simply to gain entry, which is usually one of the first acts that we take on the fire ground, that is sometimes that first form of ventilation that the fire is going to receive. So initially, it's going to want to move towards that point of low pressure. And then as we advance in, once we get on the approach, we're that approach to the seat of the fire, if we initiate a flowing and moving attack, we can not only get that local cooling and cool as we advance, but we can use that pressure front to our advantage. And now if we do get backside ventilation, that well-timed horizontal ventilation, now we provided a downstream outlet for that pressure front to move towards. So now once that opening's created, we can push all of those byproducts of combustion away from us and actually create a unidirectional flow, which is our ideal, which we historically thought was only possible through vertical means. With that line flowing and moving in that backside vent, it could actually convert that flow from bidirectional to unidirectional.
So it sounds like what you're saying is that vertical ventilation is here to stay, but at the same time, it's overused, or it's used unnecessarily when horizontal may do the job.
Exactly. So when we're looking at a fire and looking at what our tactical options are at our disposal, which is extremely important for those that are resource strapped, especially with personnel. So there's a lot of departments across the U.S., it's predominantly the case, that struggle just to get the first line into operation and simultaneously conduct a primary search. Because we have to remember that ventilation is first and foremost a support function. It's designed to support the two primary critical tasks of fire attack and search. Ventilation shouldn't precede getting a primary search done, or shouldn't come at the detriment of getting that first line into position. And that's where I think we do ourselves a disservice, especially we're limited on resources, where if horizontal and vertical are both viable options, and we have to use our resources very smartly, then using the least amount of people to get the job done in the quickest amount of time is going to be our best play, so we can use any surplus or additional personnel to commit that first line, because as the first line goes, so goes the fire. When we put the fire out, most of our problems go away. And then the sooner we can get a simultaneous search done to get hands on those remote spaces to locate and remove any trapped occupants, that's what's going to greatly enhance their chances of survival. So ventilation should be to support those two. They shouldn't come at the cost, because otherwise you're robbing Peter to pay Paul. That's where I see a lot of misuse of the tactic, where for these agencies that aren't flush with resources, that don't. Now, listen, if you've got if you're flush with resources and you have the ability to do horizontal and vertical vent at the same time, while effectively and efficiently getting the first line into position and getting a search done, then there's nothing wrong with that either. You know, the quicker we can get exchange throughout the space and improve the conditions and the tenability of the space, the better it's not going to be for not only our operations, but most importantly, the survivability of any trapped occupants. But it all comes down to triaging our resources and selecting the tactics that are going to have the desired effect in the shortest amount of time. That's really what this boils down to.
Let's talk for a minute about safety. You did allude to this in terms of peaked roofs. But what specific problems do firefighters have while they're working on a roof? Do they lose concentration or lose focus at some point? Or is it just a matter of not sounding the roof properly?
I mean, if you look at a lot of the line of duty deaths, that there's a few where the firefighters have fallen into the opening, or fallen into shaftways or skylights that have been thrown from the roof from aerial devices. So these are, I don't think, again, I don't like to Monday morning quarterback or analyze line of duty deaths, especially if we don't have a lot of that firsthand insight. There's only so much you can glean from the reports, and without having that firsthand knowledge, it's very difficult to talk about these things. But when we look about what the contributing factors were, or the causes of the objective causes of the deaths, a lot of these aren't like cases of negligence or somebody overlooking something, or that the classical lack of situational awareness that you see in a lot of these documents. We have to realize that there's a lot of uncertainty, and there is inherent risk in this profession. It's a dangerous job. And even when you do everything by the numbers, there are still unforeseen things that can happen. Now, the way that we mitigate that is through competency. The more that we know about our job, about our building construction, about fire dynamics, about the specific tactics themselves. Today we're talking about ventilation. That's how we can be as informed as possible. And the more competent we are in a skill set, or in just basic firematic skills, the more that's going to lend to our confidence, and then that's going to lead to composure. And usually when we talk about that lack of situational awareness, it's when we get pushed past, we lose that composure. You know, the stressors of the incident are pushing us outside of that healthy amount of stress. We're in that condition of, that's referred to as going off the backside of that performance curve, where, you know, the stress is becoming a hindrance now. And that's, the human factors have to be considered in these instances as well, because the stressors of this job and the uncertainty and the novelty that we sometimes encounter, there's no amount of training that can truly prepare you for those moments and allow you to you know, maintain that at that optimum, you know, stress level or control every time in the moment. So I think, again, it's easy to look at things in hindsight and in the perfect, you know, sterile environment of reading it from a document. But until you're the man in the box in that situation, there's a lot that you just can't fathom.
So is this an issue of training? Will more simulated roof work make a difference?
Oh, of course. The more we build our competency, the more that's going to lend to that confidence and composure, which is certainly going to reduce your chances of, and at least a human error. And again, like I said, there's just certain things that we just can't account for. There's going to be things that the building or the fire are going to dictate that are going to be outside of our ability to anticipate. But we can, the best way that we can prepare, and the greatest thing that we can do to enhance our you know, safety, if you will, or reduce the threat or the danger to us, is by being good at our jobs. That's really the best thing that we can do to enhance the likelihood of a successful outcome.
Well, in terms of that, I'm reminded of that Mike Tyson quote that goes, "Everyone has a plan until they get punched in the face."
Exactly, and that's in what Tyson was talking about. There was the human factor. It was the stress is a necessary evil. But again, when we get to put in those extreme circumstances, whether it's just we're put in immediate peril, or there's novelty, or just general uncertainty because of whatever the circumstance is, it's going to push us past that realm of where the stress is going to be positive. We're going to be into that negative unless we have strategies and we can do things that can allow us to regain that composure. But again, in certain circumstances, there's no amount of techniques in that moment that are going to allow you to do that. There's just certain instances where it's just simply instinct and intuition you can only act. You can't think in those moments because of the time constraint. But again, the training and understanding and really taking the time to prepare and be ready by being students of our craft is going to be one of the greatest things that we can do to enhance our chances of success.
Now, firefighters are like pilots in that they will watch video of accidents to try to figure out what happened. Does a firefighter learn anything from watching video of another crew's roof accident?
So again, we need to really reevaluate the way that we view film and critique these videos or these after action reports or NIOSH reports, because they're just snapshots. It's partial information. And Jason Bresler from who's a captain with the FDNY, who's done tremendous things within that agency, and it was one of the plank owners of their mental performance initiative, and owns a company on the side called Leadership Under Fire that my department's done extensive work with, and I've been a student of theirs for the last decade now, and they specifically talk about the human factors and how much attention that we need to start paying to them. And we do a very good job of addressing the tactical side in recent years with the emphasis on health and wellness. We're now addressing the physical side in a more appropriate way. Now we're heading in a positive direction where now the mental side is getting appreciated as well. And something that's what they refer to as the performance triad. It's the mental, physical, and the tactical. You know, those are the three facets of high performance. So we need to make sure that we're equally addressing them. And he talks a lot about, you know, green files and red files. So the fire service tends to over-focus on the red files. You know, we focus on only the things that went bad. And we keep imprinting the negative in all these causations, close calls and line of duty deaths. What we need to be doing is equally, if not more, focusing on the green files, the good cases of showing people what right looks like. Because we naturally, as humans, have a negativity bias. We instinctively will pick out what doesn't belong, you know, those outliers. But the way we do that is the way we identify what's an outlier, what doesn't belong, is by understanding what right looks like. We have to have that baseline to understand how the fire should be behaving or how the building should be behaving under, you know, quote unquote, normal circumstances. So that way, if we see something that is out of place, our mind is instinctively going to recognize that because of that negativity bias. So I think the emphasis needs to be on painting that picture of what right looks like, so we can give people that baseline and have that goalpost for them to move towards, and, you know, have those objectives and those benchmarks of successful execution of that operation. That needs to be the emphasis.
And we'll leave it there, Nick Papa. Thanks for talking with me today on Code 3.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Nick made some good points about the use of vertical ventilation. What do you do to make sure you're prepared to ventilate a roof the right way and safely? I'd be interested to hear what you do to minimize risks while you work on the roof. You can leave your comments on our website at code3podcast.com/roofrisks. That's also where you'll find links to Nick's articles on opening up the roof, so check it out. All right, that's it. That's all for this edition of Code 3. Thank you for listening. I'll be back next time with more. I'm Scott Orr, and until then, stay safe. Make some good points about the use of vertical ventilation. What do you do to make sure you're prepared to ventilate a roof the right way and safely? I'd be interested to hear what you do to minimize risks while you work on the roof. You can leave your comments on our website at code3podcast.com/roofrisks. That's also where you'll find links to Nick's articles on opening up the roof, so check it out. All right, that's it. That's all for this edition of Code 3. Thank you for listening. I'll be back next time with more. I'm Scott Orr, and until then, stay safe.
To contact us, get